Thank you. Is Vasily here?
Yes.
Oh, good. And where's the box?
In back in the office.
Could someone get that?
Yep.
It's out here.
Okay. I'll get it.
Okay, yeah, you can get that. Set this up first. Ah. So, in my previous speeches, I spoke about the free software movement, about software that respects the user's freedom. And I explained why software users deserve four essential freedoms. Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and change it so that the program does what you wish. Freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to distribute exact copies, make and distribute exact copies when you wish. And freedom three, the freedom to contribute to your community, the freedom to make and distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. If a program gives you all four of these freedoms, it is free software, freedom respecting software, svobodny software. So, once the GNU plus Linux system existed in the 90s and people started to use it, I started getting invited to give more speeches. And at the end of the speech, sometimes people would ask whether the same ideas of the free software movement, that all software should be free and all users should have these freedoms, do those apply to anything but software? Sometimes they would say, well, what about hardware? Should computers be free, or microphones, or tables, or chairs? Well, that was a silly question, because it doesn't even make sense entirely. What would it mean for this table to be free in the same sense? Well, it would mean you have freedom zero, the freedom to use the table as you wish. Well, if you buy the table, you pretty much can use it as you wish. So you have freedom zero. What about freedom one, the freedom to study the source code of the table and then change it to make the table do what you wish? Well, there is no source code. So this freedom doesn't entirely make sense. But you can study the table and you can modify the table. This table is made of wood. I could cut an inch off every leg if I wanted to, and I have a lower table. You know, there are various modifications you can do. So, and the fact is, for the most part, nobody will stop you. If it's your table, you can modify it. So you have freedom zero and you have freedom one partly to the extent it makes sense. But on the other hand, a computer, you basically can't modify very much. It's impossible. Nobody can modify the circuitry in a chip. You would just destroy it. Can we open the window? It's getting hot in here. What about freedom two, the freedom to copy and distribute the copies? Well, there are no copiers for tables. So that's completely meaningless. And what about freedom three, the freedom to copy and distribute copies of your modified versions of the table? Well, if you change this table by cutting an inch off each leg, well, there's still no copiers, so you won't be able to put the modified table into a copier and distribute copies to people. So basically, these physical objects, in most cases, are as free as they could possibly be, but that's a very partial extent. So that was a silly question. He didn't really understand. The people who asked that question about hardware didn't really understand what free means. They didn't think carefully. But there are other things about which this question makes sense. And those are other works of authorship that you might have a copy of. Because those you can copy and those you can modify. And so the question of whether you are permitted to do so is a real and important question. That is the question that this speech is about. If you have a copy of something, some word, which is not software, then for the most part, the only thing that could restrict your freedom to copy or distribute or modify it is copyright law. So the same question looked at from the other side is, what should copyright law say about those works? Now, to think about issues of copyright law, it's useful to look at the history. And the history of copyright law is connected with the history of copying technology for very good reasons. Because changes in technology can affect our ethical judgments. Now, changes in technology cannot touch our basic ethical principles, which are too deep for mere changes in technology to reach them. But when we apply these principles to a specific question, we do it by looking at various alternative choices and looking at the consequences of each one. A change in the context can alter the consequences of the same action and thus make it more good or more bad. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, then murder wouldn't be so bad. You would just say, all right, if you killed him, you have to pay for his new body, and that's it. So let's look at the history of copyright and copying technology. Copying began in the ancient world, where it was done with a writing instrument on a writing surface. Now this copying technology has some interesting consequences. First of all, there was no built-in economy of scale. Making 10 copies took 10 times as much work as making one copy. Excuse me. I'm looking for my clock, which I thought was in here. Another consequence of the ancient world's copying technology was it did not use any specialized equipment, only the ordinary equipment for writing. And it didn't require any special skill, only the skill of reading and writing. The result was a decentralized system in which copies of any given book were made in quantities starting at one, wherever somebody had a copy and wanted another. As far as I can tell, there was no such thing as copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy and you wanted to copy it, you could do so and no one would object, except perhaps if the king didn't like what the book said, and then he might put you in prison or kill you or whatever. Of course, that was censorship, not copyright, but the two are closely related. So there was no system of copyright anywhere in the ancient world, as far as I know. But then there was a tremendous advance in copying technology, the printing press, which made copying more efficient, but not uniformly so. It made some kinds of copying a lot more efficient and didn't help in other kinds. Because the printing press has a big economy of scale. It takes a lot of work to set the type, probably more work than writing a copy by hand. But once you have set the type, you can make many identical copies very efficiently. Furthermore, the printing press and the type were expensive specialized equipment that most literate people did not have. And it took special knowledge to use them, different skills from the skills of reading and writing. So the result was a centralized system of producing copies, where copies of any given book were made in a few places, And then they were brought to whoever wanted to buy them. In the first few centuries of printing, many copies were still made by hand. I recall it was a large fraction of all the copies that were almost half. This was done either on behalf of very rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people. Because as the song goes, time ain't money if all you've got is time. In the first few centuries of printing, printed books were still pretty expensive. And there were poor people who couldn't afford a printed copy, but they had the time to write a copy. Copyright began in the age of the printing press. For instance, in Italy, in the 1500s, it was commonplace that if you wrote a book, you could then ask a prince to give you a monopoly on printing it. And if he liked you, and if the book started by saying nice things about him, then he would probably give you this monopoly. Princes used to hand out monopolies of all sorts of things. To whoever they wished to reward. Copyright in England began as a system of censorship in the 1500s. If someone wanted to publish a book, someone had to apply to the government for permission. And this permission was given to one publisher, and it was a permanent monopoly for that publisher. In the 1600s, there was a revolution in England, and the system of censorship became obsolete. That was the revolution of 1688. And they began to think of getting rid of that system and replacing it with another system designed to be good for the public. And so they established a system where copyright was given to the author for a limited period of time. At that time, I believe it was 14 years. When the U.S. Constitution was written, there was a proposal that authors should be entitled to a copyright. You'd never believe it from listening to the U.S. companies today, but that proposal was rejected. And the U.S. Constitution says, Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the exclusive use of their respective writings and inventions. And in U.S. law, this one sentence is the sum total of everything there is in common between copyright law and patent law. Everything else is different. In any case, we can see a few things from this sentence. First of all, the Constitution does not require copyright to exist. It only permits the option of having a copyright system. Second, it says that if copyright exists, its purpose is to promote progress. The purpose is not to give authors something that they deserve. It doesn't say that they deserve anything. It only allows the system of copyright as a way to promote progress. And third, it says copyright can only be for a limited time. These were wise decisions, and ever since, the publishers have been trying to get rid of them. Copyright in the age of the printing press operated as an industrial regulation. It restricted publishers. The decisions were made by authors, And all of this was organized so as to benefit the general public. Because it acted as an industrial regulation, nobody ever thought about prosecuting somebody for making copies by hand. It applied to publication and printing, not hand copying for your own use. No one would even have thought of that, because everyone understood it was meant as an industrial regulation. And because of this, copyright was easy to enforce, pretty much uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial for the general public. It was easy to enforce because it didn't require invading everybody's home and computer. It only had to be applied in cases of publication. And it's easy to find out who is printing the books. You go to a bookstore and say, where did these copies come from? It was uncontroversial because it didn't restrict what the readers could do. It only restricted what you could do as a publisher. And ordinary readers were not publishers, so they never felt any burden from it. And it was arguably beneficial because the public traded certain nominal freedoms that the public was not in a position to exercise, and thus lost effectively nothing, and in exchange received benefits of more writing, more books you could buy, more conversation about important issues that might help society decide what to do. So, in the age of the printing press, copyright seemed to be beneficial, and I would not be criticizing it. But the age of the printing press is giving way slowly, gradually, to the age of the computer networks. Another major advance in copying technology, which once again makes copying more efficient. And once again, this advance is not uniform. It affects some cases more than others. In the ancient world, copying was always hard and slow. The printing press made some cases a lot more efficient. And now, computer networks make it all a lot more efficient. And the variation in efficiency is much less now. We don't have mass production of identical copies, very efficient, and everything else very painful. Now everything is pretty easy and fast. This is not perfectly true. It remains the case, for instance, that mass-produced CDs are cheaper and more durable than one-off CDs. But one-off CDs are cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people can make them. So we're in a situation, once again, like the ancient world, where anybody who can use the word can copy it too. This completely changes the effect of copyright law, even if the law itself were unchanged. Because now, the freedom that we traded away because we couldn't use it, now we can use it. Now it's important to us. The result is that copyright law has changed its social role. It is no longer an industrial regulation on publishers in the hands of authors to benefit the public. Now it restricts the public. It's controlled by the publishers, and they do it only in the name of the authors. So everything's been turned upside down by this technological change. And back in the 70s, you could see that the publishers were up to no good, because they started talking about how digital technology created problems for copyright law. And that is clearly backwards, because after all, laws are supposed to do something that's good in the situation that we are in. So I would have said, enjoying the use of digital technology. But the publishers turned it around because their goal was the opposite of our goal. Our goal is to get the best good we can out of our computers. Their goal was to stop us from doing that. Digital technology is useful because it facilitates copying and manipulating and communicating information. They don't want that to be easy for us. They don't want us to get the full benefits of our computers. So, what would a democratic government do in a situation like this? When this democratic government trades away our freedom to get benefits from us, except that now we want to start using that freedom, what would the government say? It would say to those publishers, sorry, we used to trade away these freedoms on behalf of our citizens because they didn't mind and they were happy to encourage writing, but now they want to keep these freedoms, so we can't continue the same deal that we used to make. Now we're going to have to reduce it. Maybe we can trade you part of this freedom, but the public wants to keep the rest, and it's our duty to represent the interests of the public. That, in theory, is what a democratic government does. It represents the interests of the public. We can measure how undemocratic various governments are by the extent to which they have done the exact opposite. Extending copyright power when they ought to reduce it. For instance, there is a worldwide press to make copyright last longer and longer. In the 1700s, copyright in the UK lasted, I think, 14 years. In the US, it lasted 14 years but could be renewed once. Well, in the U.S., in recent decades, it has been extended over and over and over. And the last time was in 1998, when they extended copyright by 20 more years for existing works and potential future works. Now, what possible justification could there be for extending copyright on works already written? Works, for instance, written in the 1920s. How could they convince, motivate, incent the now dead authors of the 1920s to write more back then by extending copyright now? They never answered that question for us, and if they had a time machine, they apparently did not use it, because our history books do not record that there was an explosion of artistic activity in the 1920s when authors learned that in 1998 they would be granted 20 more years of copyright. It is at least vaguely conceivable that extending copyright for future works could create more motivation to write them, but practically speaking, no. And the reason is that copyright already lasted such a long time that additional time tacked on to the end of that had a discounted economic value so small it wouldn't motivate anything. What really happened, the real reason for this, was companies like Disney paid for the law. You see, that's why we call it the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. You see, the character Mickey Mouse was going to go into the public domain. Mickey Mouse appeared for the first time in a movie called Steamboat Willie in 1929. So, the time when its copyright was going to expire was getting close. And if that happened, others could make movies that would have Mickey Mouse in them, or other publications that had pictures of Mickey Mouse in them. And Disney didn't want that to ever happen. So they paid for this 20-year extension. And this, but really they want copyright to last forever. In fact, the Motion Picture Association of America says it wants perpetual copyright. But even they don't have enough power yet to amend the U.S. Constitution to permit that. So they worked out a scheme to get the same results without admitting it, which we call perpetual copyright on the installment plan. The idea is that every 20 years they extend copyright 20 more years, and they will do that forever. Thus, at any given time, if you pick a particular work, there is a certain date when it's supposed to go into the public domain. But don't hold your breath, because by the time you get there, it will have been postponed 20 years. And by the time you get there, it will be postponed 20 more years. And this way, they hope, nothing will ever go into the public domain again. And in fact, nothing has gone into the public domain in the U.S. for decades. The duration is one dimension of copyright power. The other dimension is the extent of the power. Which activities, which uses are controlled by copyright? Now, in the age of the printing press, copyright was never supposed to control all uses of a copyrighted work. In the broad space of all the things you could do with the work, copyright was an exception. The rest were unregulated uses. However, the publishers have envisioned that with digital technology, they can totally control access. They hope to establish a pay-per-read universe where you have to get permission even to read a part of a book. This is done with digital restrictions management, or DRM, which means designing products so that they restrict the users, specifically products for playing music, playing videos, reading books, or accessing any sort of information. They're designed to control you, not serve you. And we have seen this problem in a broad spectrum of different kinds of works. For instance, we see it in videos. DVDs were the first widely adopted product designed to restrict the user. DVD movies are usually in an encrypted format. And the format details were secret. The DVD conspiracy was set up to make sure the public would not be able to access the data on DVDs except in limited, restricted ways. Here's how it works. This conspiracy knows the format of DVDs. Anybody that wants to make a DVD player has to go to the conspiracy and ask for the secret. And the conspiracy says, we will tell you the secret if you sign this contract where you promise that your DVD players will restrict the users just like all other DVD players. We require that of all the manufacturers of DVD players. This is why there is effectively no competition in DVD players, because they, no matter how many different manufacturers there are, all the players restrict the users the same way. Naturally, people try to escape from these restrictions. People, in fact, figured out the format of DVD encryption and wrote a free program to break the encryption. That program is censored in the U.S. today. Is the window actually open? Okay. still it's getting hotter.
It's free.
Thanks for, yeah, if you can get it open any more, that'll help. There are a lot of people in here, and we really need ventilation. So, the United States practices censorship of software. This was established by a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, also in 1998, which says that when works are published in encrypted form or in any form that is designed to restrict the public, then distributing anything that enables people to escape from these restrictions is a crime. In other words, instead of defending us, which is what the government should have done, it joined with our enemies to oppress us. So I call it the government of occupation. For the corporate empire. Now people ask me how I know about this conspiracy. The answer is, it's not secret. They announce the existence of this conspiracy. They have so little fear that anything will be done to stop them from attacking the public that they don't even see a need to hide what they're doing. I think what they're doing ought to be a crime. Any conspiracy of companies to restrict the technology available to the public should be a crime. But that would require a democratic government, and there are not very many of those left in the world. Now, because even though that program is censored, it is widely available. You can get a copy of the free software to play a DVD. It's not hard. Now, in some other countries, it's a crime even to have a copy. For instance, in France, you can be put in prison just for having a copy of the free software to play a DVD. But the fact is, the software is available. So they have designed a new scheme to restrict the access to HD DVD and Blu-ray discs. That scheme is called AACS, but I call it the axe. And we should give it the axe. So don't buy HD DVD. Don't buy Blu-ray. Don't buy any product with digital restrictions management unless you personally have the means to break the restrictions in the product. Now, in fact, people have broken the axe. A year ago, code was released that carries out the proper algorithm. Keep it open, it's still hot in here. Please keep it open, it's still hot. Well, how about if I stand over there? Well, man, it seems inconvenient to get there. There's a sort of mountain in the way. And then, a few months later, I saw a strange photo. A friend showed it to me. It showed two very cute, adorable puppies, and above them, there were 16 hex numbers. And I asked myself, what in the world is this? Why put those 16 hex digits together with these two cute puppies? I wonder if it's some sort of key. And it turns out that was the key to break the axe. Somebody posted this on a site called Dig, and the editors deleted it because publishing that in the U.S. is illegal, is censored. And then, somebody else posted it again, and they took it down again. And hundreds of people posted it, and then the editor said, okay, we give up. We can't stop people from circulating this information. And eventually, these 16 hex digits were posted on over 700,000 web pages in a strong show of public opposition to these conspiracies to restrict our technology. But this doesn't mean the axe is defeated, because it's designed so they can change the key, and they did. So perhaps the people who found that key should have waited a year or two, because the disks that were already published, those can be decoded, but the future ones, which will use a new key, those will not be decodable until somebody finds that key. So that the people engaged in breaking DRM have to think strategically. It's like you're breaking the enemy's codes. How do you cause the enemy the most damage? How do you set back? How do you basically work to defeat our enemy? Because all those companies making things designed to restrict our use of our technology are our enemies. We have also seen DRM in music. Starting most of a decade ago, we started to see things that looked like CDs, but they were not real CDs because they didn't follow, they were not real compact discs because they didn't follow the specifications of the CD format. So we called them corrupt discs. I was once invited to give a speech on this topic by one of the regions of Spain. And then they gave me a gift, some records of music from the region. And one of them I was really curious to listen to, but before I opened it, I noticed that instead of saying compact disc, it said copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems. Meaning it can't be played with free software. It was a good thing I hadn't opened it yet, because I handed it back to my host and I said, here you see the face of the enemy. Please take this back to the store, because they shouldn't be able to keep your money. I don't want them to get any money from me, and they shouldn't get your money either. So I've never heard that music, but that's okay. I'd rather not hear that music than accept DRM. Sony, about 3 years ago, implemented a very interesting DRM scheme. When you put on music recordings, you would put this corrupt disc into the computer, and it would load software into the system without telling you. And that software was called a rootkit because it's something like what security breakers do, crackers. It's somewhat like what a virus might do. So that software was installed deep into the system, and then it modified some of the system commands so that they would lie and disguise the presence of that software. And it modified other commands so that it would be hard to remove that software. Now, this was a crime, in fact. But that's not all, because it also damaged the security of the computer, and it contained, it also committed copyright infringement because it contained free software that had been released under the GNU GPL, included in a combination that was not free and without giving the user a copy of the GNU GPL to inform him of his rights. People got very angry at this. But unfortunately, most of the anger focused on all the other side nasty things that Sonny had done, and not on the nasty purpose of it all, which was to restrict the user's access to the music that they had bought. It turns out, though, that there were a couple of things that made this scheme actually less harmful than most. First of all, it only affected Windows users. And second, even a Windows user could protect himself by holding down a certain key on the keyboard while putting the disk in. So it was actually fairly easy to bypass. But millions of people didn't know about this, so their machines got infected. They got very angry, they sued Sony, and Sony settled the suit by promising that next time they try to control your access to your copies of your data, they wouldn't do the other secondary nasty things. But they learned their lesson. Next time the rootkit will be built in before you get the machine, and it will be impossible to remove. And that's already the case in the PlayStation 3, which is a very nasty thing. We also see attempts to impose digital restrictions management on books. Several years ago, there was a powerful campaign, in some countries at least, trying to convince us to switch to e-books. And of course, these e-books have DRM. Basically, the publishers want to take away certain traditional freedoms of readers. Freedoms to do things like sell a book to a used bookstore, borrow it from the public library, buy it anonymously by paying cash, or lend it to your friend. And even the freedom to keep the book for as long as you like and read it many times and then pass it on to your children and they might read it and pass it on. All these freedoms they want to take away from us. They want total control over what we do with our books. But there are so many people that read books and are accustomed to certain freedoms that they would have trouble passing a law in the U.S. taking away these freedoms from readers. So they came up with a two-stage plan to achieve the same goal. The first stage was take away these freedoms for e-books. And that they achieved fairly easily. That's the result of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was passed in 1998 by the House of Representatives without even bothering to vote because nobody wanted to say, I demand a vote on this. The second stage was to convince people to switch from printed books to e-books. That, they tried and it didn't work. Now, there was an organized PR campaign to convince people to use e-books. I know this because in 2001 I was in an airplane in Brazil on a domestic flight and I pulled out the in-flight magazine, which I rarely do, and where an ordinary magazine would have an editorial, this one had an article discussing the question of how many years it would take before we were all using e-books. Now, those magazines never publish anything unless they have a specific business reason to do so. Either it convinces people to fly more, or they're paid. So I know there was an organized campaign for this. One publisher thought it would be effective to start off its line of e-books with my biography. So they found an author and sent him to me, and he asked if I would cooperate, and I said, sure, provided this book is published without encryption. So he was said yes. And the book was written and published, and it not only is not encrypted, it's actually free. You can download the whole text with markup, and then you can edit it and publish your own version. Well, ebooks were a failure commercially, and I had been telling people for years, they'll try again. Well, now they're trying again. We've seen a couple of ebook readers announced recently. There is the Sony Shredder, which describes what it will do to our books. And there is the Amazon Swindle. And make sure your friends know before they buy one of these that buying one of these is tantamount to saying, I'm not going to lend my friends books anymore. So it means being a jerk. Make sure your friends know that if they buy one of these and start using it, you, and it should be lots of people who tell them this, will interpret that as basically a refusal to be friends anymore. So, across the board, we have seen attempts to use digital technology in our own computers against us, to subject us to the power of the publishers. They want to control whatever we do with our own copies, taking away rights that legally otherwise we would still have under copyright law. They're trying to make copyright total control. They do this because they buy the support of governments, and governments don't defend us. But what would a democratic government do? Oh, I should mention one other dimension of extending copyright power, and that is increasing the penalties for unauthorized copying. And there, Russia may be the world champion with 6-year punishments for unauthorized copying. That law is a total injustice. It should be eliminated. But what would democratic governments do? Well, they would reduce copyright power so that we, the general public, keep some of our natural rights instead of trading them away. But what more specifically? First of all, they should reduce copyrights. They should reduce copyright in each dimension. First of all, there's a dimension of time. While copyright has been extended and extended, the publication cycle is getting shorter and shorter. In the U.S. today, most books are remaindered, which means sold off cheap, within 2 years, and they go out of print within 3. So they don't need copyright to last for up to 150 years. So I propose that copyright should last for 10 years, starting with the date of publication. I say starting with the date of publication because while the work remains unpublished, we don't have copies. So we're not losing anything. It's a purely theoretical question whether we would be allowed to copy them if we had them. We might as well let the author have however long it takes to find a publisher for the work. But then it should be 10 years. Now, I propose this as a first adjustment. I'm not saying I'm sure 10 years is right. I'm saying let's try 10 years. Let's see how it works. Maybe we'll want to extend it some. Maybe we'll want to shorten it even more. I don't know. 10 years seems, because 10 years is 3 times the usual publication cycle, I'm comfortable that it's long enough. However, not everyone agrees with this. I proposed this at a panel discussion with some writers. And I expected fireworks, and I got some. Because the award-winning fantasy writer sitting next to me said, 10 years? Absolutely not. Anything more than 5 years is unacceptable. Now, I was surprised when he said that, because I had been believing the publisher's propaganda since the publisher said they were doing this for the authors. I assumed naively that the authors wanted this too. But the fact is, those same publishers that demand more power over us in the name of the authors are driving those authors into the ground with their heels frequently. For instance, this author, the writer who objected, who didn't want more than 5 years copyright, he had a legal dispute with his publisher. You see, his contract said that if the book went out of print, if the books went out of print, the rights would revert to him, and he would be allowed to distribute copies again. Well, practically speaking, he had found that his book was out of print. People couldn't get it. But the publisher refused to acknowledge that and was using copyright to stop him from distributing copies of his own books, which he wanted to do so that people could read them. He knew that unless he became a superstar, more than 10 years of copyright was not likely to do, more than 5 years of copyright was not likely to do him much good. So he said 5 years maximum. Well, maybe we could try 10 years, and maybe if we are, maybe we'll decide then to shorten it even more. I won't argue against it. I just propose 10 years as a good first adjustment, which we could then further adjust. But what about the other dimension of copyright? Its extent, its the range of activities it covers. Well, we should reduce that too, but not the same for everything. I don't think that we should treat all works the same. And I distinguished three broad categories of works that I think we should treat in different ways, each one according to the way it's used. These categories are, first, functional, practical works, works that you use to do a job in your life. Second, works of opinion and testimony, the works that whose social contribution is they say what certain people thought. Third, the works of art and entertainment, whose social contribution lies in the impact of the work itself. Three different ways that a work can contribute to society. And because these contributions work differently, I think different copyright rules are appropriate for them. First, the works, the functional practical works, the works that you use to do a practical job. These include software, recipes, educational works, reference works, text fonts, and various other things. Things that ordinary people can use to do practical jobs. These must be free. The same arguments that apply to software, why software should be free, apply to the other kinds of functional works. If you're using the work to do a job in your life, and you can't control what the work does, then you can't control your life. So you must be free to change it. And once you've changed it, you should be free to publish your version because other people might have needs similar to yours or preferences similar to yours. Your version, which you made because it's useful to you, perhaps, could be useful to other people as well. So you should be able to publish your version. And this leads to the conclusion that they have to be free. Now, people might say, but if there's no way to restrict the users and interfere with their use of the works, they'll never be made. Well, we don't have to be afraid that the sky will fall if these works are free, because now we have enough examples showing that they will be made. They are made. Even today, lots of these works are made and they are free. We have the example of the free software community, which has developed thousands of useful applications. We have the example of all the recipes that are circulating, and it's normal for cooks to copy recipes and modify recipes. And then we have, in the area of reference works, we have the example of Wikipedia and some other reference sites of a similar sort, which are free and have done a tremendous job. So there's no need to be scared. We don't need to sabotage the use of these works in order to get them developed. We should make them free. And this is the answer to that question I posed at the beginning. This is how far the ideas of free software go, in my opinion. Now, the question for the other two categories of works is the same, but I don't think it's the same answer. I mean, you could apply the same answer, but that's not what I think is right. I don't try to generalize every view of what I hold as far as it could possibly go. Because even if the answer makes sense over here, that doesn't mean it's the right answer over here. We have to think about each area. Let's look at category two, the category of works whose social contribution is they say what certain people thought. This includes memoirs and autobiographies, essays of opinion, and scientific papers. After all, the real purpose of the scientific paper is, it says, we did this, and we saw this, and the names of the authors on that paper are crucial. It wouldn't be the same if it just said, somebody did this, and somebody saw this, and we don't know who. You couldn't rely on it that way. But when their authors' names are on it, and their reputations are behind the honesty of it, and the validity of it, then it's good for something. Now, publishing a modified version of these works is not socially useful. That is just misrepresenting somebody. There's no particular reason why we want that to be allowed. And that means we could have a compromise copyright system where everyone is free to redistribute exact copies of the work non-commercially. But anything else requires permission just as now. So there would still be a copyright system, and it would cover commercial use and it would cover modification. But non-commercial distribution of exact copies, that freedom we would all have. And that, I believe, is the minimum freedom that we must have for all kinds of works. To take away this freedom is what makes copyright into tyranny. To take away this freedom, the freedom to share, is what requires draconian punishments and outrageous means of enforcement. By winning back this freedom, by making these works shareable, we can turn copyright back into an industrial regulation as it ought to be. So, that's what I recommend for these works. What about the third category, artistic and entertainment works? For that category, it was hard for me to decide about modification, because there are valid arguments on both sides. There is the argument that a work can have an artistic integrity, and modified versions could destroy that integrity. And I think this is sometimes true. Although, authors have a lot. Most authors don't have as much integrity as they pretend to. And you can see that by the way they allowed Hollywood to butcher those works in exchange for money. But there are some who won't. There are some who won't let Hollywood butcher them. They say you have to make it faithful, you have to do it right. Okay, those authors may have integrity. But on the other side, modifying art can produce good contributions, interesting contributions to art. Consider the folk process, where a series of people can transform a work and produce something very rich and beautiful. But if we want to consider only named authors, consider Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays used stories that were copied from other works published a few decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect then, those plays of Shakespeare would not have been allowed, and probably they wouldn't have been written, and surely not published or performed. So, if Shakespeare had complained about this, which he probably wouldn't have, but if he had, then the copyright holders who might have been perhaps the children of the authors, people not particularly artistic themselves, they might have said, how dare you propose to make a cheap ripoff of my father's work? It has to be a cheap ripoff because you want a copy from it. So why don't you go away and think up something else? And we, listening to this, since we would never have seen that play of Shakespeare, which would never have been written, we wouldn't know that that wasn't true. Since we have seen these plays, we can say they're great works of literature. But if we hadn't seen them, we wouldn't know that. So we could easily be misled by these arguments made by the copyright holders. For many years, I wasn't sure what to do about these two valid arguments. And then I realized that while modifying a work of art can be useful, it's not urgent. If you are using a functional work to do a job today, and it's not quite right, you have to be free to change it today. And you should be free to publish your modified version today, so tomorrow other people can get the benefit. But when it's a work of art, we could wait. So if copyright lasts for 10 years, for 10 years we could have the compromise copyright system, where people are free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies, and that's all. And then after 10 years, it'll go into the public domain, and then you could publish your modified version. So that's what I propose for art. And that's how I propose to change copyright law. That's what I think the right solution is today. In particular, this means legalizing peer-to-peer sharing. But some people say, if we share things peer-to-peer, that's taking money out of the mouths of these starving musicians. That's bullshit. The starving musicians get nothing from the present system. They can't lose what they don't get. The record companies treat musicians very badly. When I buy a commercial CD, which I do, I feel ashamed that I'm not supporting the musicians. Musicians, I know the musicians are probably going to get nothing. Zero. You might wonder about this. Isn't part of the price for the musicians? Well, yes, theoretically. But the production and publicity expenses are treated as an advance to the musicians, which means that when you buy the CD, that share, which is for the musicians, goes from one account in the record company to another. And the musicians never get it, and very few records actually sell so many copies that they finish repaying this so-called advance and start actually giving the musicians money. Some records can go gold and still not reach this point. The exception, of course, is for the long-established superstars, because they finish their first record contract, which usually covers 5 or 7 records, and then they can negotiate a new contract, and since they're superstars, they can now get a decent contract that doesn't exploit them. So if you're buying their records, they actually get something. Of course, they're rich anyway, so it's not crucial. So really, the musicians don't stand to lose anything, except for superstars who are rich. They don't stand to lose anything through peer-to-peer sharing. Now, this does not mean that musicians don't get any benefit from their record contracts, because the publicity does have an effect. That could mean more people go to their concerts. They have more concerts, and they make some money that way. And then at their concerts, they can sell things, including records, and they do make money from that. So they do benefit. But there's more than one way to give musicians publicity. In fact, this method of publicity is based on commercial planning. It's hype. It's the hype musical complex. And it distorts music. So I'd rather give musicians publicity the way I do it, which is by saying to people, listen to this, isn't it wonderful? How about emailing a copy of somebody's song to your friend? That's a great way to give musicians publicity. I'd rather see musicians get publicity this way. It not only means that we can get rid of these nasty record companies and have them stop interfering with our enjoyment of music, but it's also healthier for music to have music publicity and popularity not be controlled by money. So, aside from the superstars, musicians will not be any worse off if we legalize peer-to-peer sharing. But we might want to do a better job than the current system of supporting musicians. I would like to. And I have two proposals for how to do that. One method uses tax. You tax blank discs or internet connectivity or whatever, something that vaguely relates to enjoying music. And then you distribute that money entirely to the musicians and composers and songwriters based on their popularity, but not in linear proportion. And the reason is this. A superstar could be 1,000 times as popular as somebody else who's a successful musician and fairly popular. If you distribute the money in linear proportion, a few superstars will take almost all the money, leaving very little for all the other musicians, which means the system will work very inefficiently at supporting the activity of music. So what I propose is take the cube root of the popularity of each artist, or maybe the fourth root, or, you know, you could adjust this. The point is you have a mathematical formula, and it looks like this. So if the superstar is 1,000 times as popular and you use the cube root, well, the superstar then gets 10 times as much money instead of 1,000 times. Well, this way, a few superstars, although each one gets more than the usual amount, it still adds up just to a small fraction of the money. Meaning most of the money can go to supporting lots of other musicians who are fairly popular, but not superstars. And the result is a system that works efficiently to support the musicians who really need it, and still gives you, to whatever extent such an incentive does any good, because it could do harm instead, a external incentives can kill creativity. They can be quite harmful. But nonetheless, the superstar still can expect to get more. You know, as you get more popular, you do get more, but it's on a sliding scale. So 1,000 times the popularity doesn't give you 1,000 times as much money, only 10 times as much. And the result is, paying less than we do now to the copyright system, we could support musicians a lot better. But some people don't like taxes. I don't mind taxes. I believe in a welfare state, and a welfare state needs to collect taxes. But some people don't like taxes, so I have another approach to suggest. And that is voluntary payments. Imagine that every player has a button you can push that will send $1 to the artists. Whether it's an ebook reader or a television set or a music box, whatever. Push the button and send a dollar. Lots of people will do this. Because first of all, a dollar is not that much money. Now, there are poor people in the world who can't afford to send a dollar. And that's okay, they shouldn't. We don't need to squeeze money out of them to support the arts. There are plenty of people in the world for whom $1 is not that much, and who can push the button, and who wouldn't mind, they won't notice the money. If they push it once a week, they won't mind. And they will. I expect we can convince a lot of people even to push it once a day. And if we are not satisfied with how much money people are sending to the musicians or whoever in this way, we could have a friendly, warm, loving publicity campaign. Have you sent a dollar to the people who made a song or a movie this week or wrote a book? Why, if not, why not? Didn't you enjoy it? Send them a little bit. It's so easy, and you'll never miss the money. I think, and this would be instead of these cruel, vicious PR propaganda campaigns saying that sharing is theft. Society is based on the spirit of goodwill and the practice of sharing with and cooperating with other people in your community. To attack this is to attack society. Today's copyright law is an attack on society, and it is intolerable. But once we get rid of it, we'll have a system that treats us ethically, and if we wish to increase our support for those who write, we have easy ways to do it. So, at this point, I will answer questions. Where is the box? Is it here now? So I've got some. Did you bring the box?
Yeah, I sent somebody.
Well, he obviously didn't return.
Yes.
There must be a monster in that office who ate him up or something like that. So be careful. Bring someone else with you. Splitting up is the recipe for getting eaten. Anyway, questions?
What time do you think you're ready
yourself? I'm not sure there are any. New Zealand seems better than most. Certainly not the U.S. Bush stole the election twice. And Congress just sells laws to... Uh-oh, what's this? And certainly not the European Union, which keeps on adopting laws more and more nasty for the sake of publishers. Certainly not Russia. I read that the election, in the election for Parliament, the figures, the vote counts were too round. Apparently somebody chose what the vote counts would be, and he picked round fractions like 10% and 20%, and I'm sure next time they won't make that mistake. But you see, democracy doesn't just mean that people vote. It means that those who are especially powerful are not allowed to have political power in proportion to their own personal influence and wealth. If you let rich people deploy their influence to make people vote the way they want, then it's not democracy.
Richard, I want to talk about becoming member of Congress.
You mean for Lawrence Lessig?
Maybe for you.
Well, for Lawrence Lessig, I think he's honest, so I guess he'd be better than most of the people in Congress now. As for me, I don't think people would vote for me. For one thing, I'm an atheist. And in the U.S., an atheist can't even get elected dog catcher. A lot of people believe that atheists are evil. They believe that to be an atheist is to have no ethics. And then, well, I see plenty of people who at least claim to be religious, and in the name of their religion, they're doing horrible things. Bush says that God told him to launch his war of conquest in Iraq. But then what would you expect from a God like that? I don't know what I would do with one. I'm so busy doing what I'm already doing, I don't see how I can start anything new. But I am worried about RFIDs. Now, there are some uses for RFIDs that I think are okay. When a shipment from the manufacturer to a store has an RFID on it, for the sake of making sure that things don't get stolen, I see no harm in that. It's when they start putting RFIDs into the things we carry that it becomes dangerous. Now, I have a card that I use to pay for the subway in Boston, and it has an RFID in it. The only reason I have it is because they give you a discount if you use that. But I make sure that A, they don't know who has it, and B, I always keep it in aluminum foil, except when I actually go into the subway, and then I put it right back in. So it can't be tracked anywhere else. And third, after a couple of months, I get a new one, and I give away the old one to somebody else. And so I'm trying to get people going and swapping them around so that they are not good for surveillance. We have to resist these things. RFIDs and passports are a nasty and stupid idea. And I'm worried also about RFIDs and credit cards. I don't know. It's sometimes hard to tell. Well, that's obviously nasty, but it doesn't have to go that far to be nasty. For instance, in the U.S., a lot of people have an RFID. money in their cars, and they use this to pay toll on the highways and bridges. And of course, this means the system keeps track of everywhere they go. So people shouldn't use that. Now, those systems can be built in a way that is anonymous. You can make anonymous payment systems. The technology is not the hard part. But our government wants to spy on people. It has no respect for human rights.
Usually they mention terrorism.
Oh, yes. They all say that they're they always say they're protecting us from terrorists, unless they say they're protecting us from child pornographers, or there's some kind of demon they're protecting us from. But that's absurd, because the big danger is them.
The code is the future of free software in the era of software as a service.
Well, I don't like that term, software as a service. I think it's misleading, and I do not use it. It's a confusing way of referring to two different practices, which we need to distinguish. One of them is sites that send a program to your browser to run on your machine. And what I think is, if I'm going to run that program, I want to get it in the usual way. I want to have it installed on my machine, and I want it to be free software, and I want to be able to change my copy of it. So I consider those things totally unacceptable. But the other thing that it's confused with is using a server to do computation. And that may be okay, or it may be unacceptable, depending on details of what the computation is. Is it your computation that you do on your data, or is it some other kind of thing? Well, on most sites, it's some other kind of thing. Like, suppose it's a search engine. Well, that's looking through the company's data. You're saying, please look through your data for me. Okay. It's not your data, it's their data. Suppose you're buying something, then you're making a deal with the owner of the site. That's not doing your computation with your data. It's not something you could do on your own computer. On the other hand, look at Google Docs, where that's basically, it's a spreadsheet and a word processor, and it sends a large program to run your browser. And that's not good, because that program is not free. But, okay, suppose they made that program free. Well, there'd still be a problem, and that is their server, you're using their server to do your computing with your data. And you should have control of that. But if you do it on somebody else's server, you don't have control. And note that it doesn't matter whether the software in the server is free. Suppose, because, you know, a lot of the software running on that server is free software. And the rest is probably custom software. Google is the only user, only Google has it. They've never released it in any fashion, I would expect. Well, that's okay as far as it goes, but the point is, you don't control what it does on their server. But suppose that they release all the source code for that custom software. You still wouldn't control what it does on their server. It would all be free software, but if you run it on their server, you don't control it. If it were free software, you could install it on your computer, and then you would control it. So the point is that for doing your own computing on your data, if you want to have control, you have to do it on your computer with your copy of the program, and it has to be free software. So, some kinds of web servers are okay, some cause a problem. This is a different kind of issue. Its structure is different from the issue of free versus proprietary software. We have to think about it differently.
What's your opinion about the activity of various standard relation committees, especially those which
Well, standards are useful. It's a way of achieving compatibility. For instance, it's useful that there is a C standard, and that C compilers will interpret a lot of things the same way.
But maybe my question is about different things. What about the case when they actually change languages, like C99?
It's useful, you know. People came up with ways to improve C. Some of the changes in C99 came from me. I implemented extensions in GCC, and some of them people liked, and they were put into the C spec. Great.
Oh,
first of all, scientific articles, papers, are in the second category. They're works of testimony. Okay, let me answer. I'm trying to answer you, okay? So, I believe that we should all have the freedom to, at least the freedom to not commercially redistribute exact copies of them. So that's what I'd recommend. Release them under a license that permits that. Now, you could permit commercial exact copying too, right? No reason not to if you want to. So those, for instance, there are two Creative Commons licenses that do this. There's the no derivatives, no commercial license, and there's the no derivatives license. And I think they're both fine. Now, the journal publishers try to prevent this. So right now, science is faced with the obstruction of the publishers of scientific journals who are trying to interfere with the dissemination of scientific knowledge for the sake of their own profits. We have to defeat them. We have to perhaps get rid of them. Now, the way I suggest for this is that universities should sign contracts with all their faculty and staff and students where the university reserves in advance the right of second publication on the university's website of the final version of any article that they publish after it has been published by somebody else. So they have to look for a publication in the same way they do now. And once that's done, the university can put a copy on its website under one of those two CC licenses. And this way, everything becomes available. The nice thing about this is that it doesn't matter what the authors sign with the journal publisher, because they can't take away the rights that the university already has. Of course, even better would be to simply put this into a law. Or, for instance, funding agencies that fund research could make this a requirement, and one already has. I believe it's called the Wellcome Trust, which funds biological research or medical research, and they make it a requirement. If you get their funding, you have to agree to one way or another. I don't know if it's exactly the same as this, but one way or another, they require the authors to publish their articles in ways that are open to the public and allow redistribution. So we're starting to do this. If enough funding sources do this, we will win the fight.
Берите микрофон, чтобы запись попала.
What? I don't understand. How about if you ask a question?
Before I ask a question,
pottery with a fossil patient going on. I mean, the governments are now mutual supporters of free software in some of these aspects. But they do not agree with this idea as a whole.
We should cooperate with them when they propose to do something that advances our freedom.
Alright, but if there is no absolute agreement, can you sacrifice anything?
I don't understand. It's too general, I'm sorry. I don't know how to think about such a general question.
Alright, for example, you propose some new amendments to the copyright law.
Sorry, new what?
Amendments.
Okay.
And we cannot get the whole thing, so in the final step, the copyright law remains dead.
Well, if it's a step in the right direction, we can support it, but we have to be clear and say it's only part, it only corrects part of the problem.
Okay, thanks.
So we have to advocate what is needed to really solve the problem, but if we win only part of that, it's still a victory, a partial victory.
If copyright goes out of effect in 10 years, then new GPL software would not be new GPL in 10 years.
That's right. It would not be GPL in 10 years anymore. Well, what I propose for works in the first category, functional practical works, is they should all be free.
Ah.
Sorry, do you want to ask a question?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to apply it against the wall with the brown
color. Mr. Stoman, you said that about the way to support musicians and writers by pressing button and sending them money. But do you really believe that lots of people will push this button?
Oh, sure, we know it. For instance, a few months ago, Radiohead released a record and said, pay as much as you like. And they didn't say how much money they got, but the estimates are they got millions of dollars. And the same record was being distributed at the same time through BitTorrent. So I think it's now proved that it's not only possible to support musicians this way, but they can even get rich.
I can actually have a more recent example. Just 2 days ago, 19 Nails released the latest album under Creative Commons Share Alike license.
Wow!
And they published the first 9 tracks for that album, or 36 tracks, at the website for free. That instantly got into the Pirate Bay torrent. And then you can buy for $5 all the tracks in FLAC or MP3 format without DRM. Or you can pay $10, $70, or $300 for different packages.
Oh, good.
$300 package is already sold out. That was 2,500 packages.
What this shows is a lot of people like giving money to the musicians whose work they love. You know, anybody who bought that $300 package, he was not trying to save money. He was expressing his love. And the thing is, art can do that. Art makes people, arouses people's intense feelings. When people love works of art, they want to support the artists. And in the past, it has been too hard. You know, there are many times when I would have happily sent some money to some musicians, but how in the world would I do that? It was too much work. If all I could do was push a button, suppose I could send $10 by pushing this button 10 times, well, that's so easy. Of course I would do it. Well, if they're not so popular, they won't get so much money, obviously, but...
Yeah, unknown.
Well, what happens to unknown musicians today? For the most part, they don't get anything. You know, for the most part, unknown musicians supported by their record companies, and they don't get any money if you buy their CDs. So when people who think that we would lose something important if we get rid of the present system, or even partly get rid of the present system, which is what I'm proposing after all, they are taking for granted something that isn't true. The publishers, they always say, we're doing this to support these artists. It's easy to make the mistake of believing that the current system does support the artists, and the fact is it almost always does not. There are rare exceptions. They're not zero, but they're rare, who make it big and get rich. And then there are all the others who have some success, but the current system doesn't support them. You know, it supports the superstars.
Each of these licenses, do you mean as the best approximation of your second case to use it?
Second case?
Yes.
Which is second?
The second case, same and
other testimony. Well, as I said, there is a Creative Commons license. It's the CC, no derivatives, no commercial license that permits non-commercial redistribution of exact copies. And that's the least permissive Creative Commons license. And it's okay for these works. But of course, if you choose to permit more, that's okay too. So any Creative Commons license is okay for these two categories.
I assure that the physical license is appropriated now to use it, to publish student and scientific works from the some university.
Yes. Commercial redistribution as well when I publish something. My essays, they permit distribution of exact copies, and they don't limit this to non-commercial.
What way do you see promoting the free software business? Because also it is rather
for the population. I'm not an expert on that. I don't focus on business. I focus on teaching people about the human rights that they should have as software users. You see, part of the reason why business has so much power is that many people fawn on business. They say, oh, how can I convince business to do this, to accept this idea? But if you focus on convincing business, that means you're accepting the values of business. Well, I don't accept those values, and that's my most important point. So I don't want to give these speeches as if I were talking to business. My main point is about the rest of life, about the values that business ignores. I don't say they're all evil. What I'm saying is that I don't want to... You see, business is one narrow area of life. If you focus on business, in effect, you're treating that narrow area of life as if it were everything, and ignoring everything outside that. And that is harmful. So I'm not saying that these businesses should never exist. I'm not a communist. But I do say that what I care about is other values.
But may I say, regarding the institutions, how do you practically think that it could be done in the past? How is it implemented?
I am not an expert, but I know the technology exists. Technology, for instance, for digital cash has been developed. It's not a technical problem, it's a social problem. How do you get this to put into effect? That's a hard problem. But how designing the algorithms is not the problem. I'm not an expert on that area, I just know that the methods exist.
I meant to say that some people,
much.
Sorry, to see nature in what?
In online payments.
Printing
and so on.
Online payments. Well, I see danger in it too, because right now e-commerce requires a credit card, it's not anonymous. So I don't do it. I don't buy things with credit cards, I buy things with cash in a store, a physical store, because I don't want it to be recorded who, where I was, what I bought. I see that as dangerous. I agree. Well, maybe we agree. You're saying the same thing, and we agree.
Yep. That was just the concern, not my concern, of the practicality of that.
Okay, so I have to leave. I have to stop in 2 minutes. Because I have to get out of here by 8. Okay, he asked again, so what's that? Let him make a question.
What would you say about such technology? If I buy a table, I don't have to give the manufacturer any information about me. And if I buy a copyrighted software, I should give a lot of information.
Well, actually, that's not necessarily true. You might be able to go to a store and buy a copy. And after all, you can buy a copyrighted book in a store, and you can pay cash, and they don't know who you are. But I agree that anonymity is an important right. And in general, non-free software tramples your rights in a lot of ways. That's why I say don't use non-free software. Protect your freedom.
Thank you. Also, the school is free, but do you understand that always will be some fields where software can't be free, such as military technologies and...
Well, that's different. You see, the software for military use is not available to the public at all. That's different from proprietary software. Microsoft doesn't say, you can't have Windows, it's a secret. They say, sure you can have it, but you don't control it, we control you. I'm not against private software that you develop and then you use in one, you know, a company might use it internally and not release it to the public. That I don't criticize. What I do criticize is when they offer it to you, but in a way that tramples your freedom. So now I better end the question period. I should point out that there are stickers here. Please take the stickers, and I'm sure that some of you will be able to make use of what, if these aren't taken from one organization or another, will be able to take these. So, and I have a few pins. These pins I'm selling for 200 rubles, and I'm going to give the money to a Russian organization for free software. I don't know which one yet, but that's where it will go. So if you want to buy one of these pins for 200 rubles, it will support the free software movement.
This not sell?
No, this is I have lots of hundreds. Okay. Later, I'm doing something else. This is a donation. It's 200 rubles for this.
Huh?
Okay. Thank you. So you'll want a lot of change. Okay. Okay. platform. But you can
read still,
yes.
And it didn't have a choice then.
I don't understand the scenario you're talking about. I'm sorry, but there are other people who want other things, so I don't know if I have time for this conversation now. I have to leave very soon. So I'm sorry, but I wish I had more time, but I don't. I don't know if I can answer it right now. It's because I have to do these, and then I have to leave. And it's hard for me to think at the same time, I won't sign this. It has to, Ubuntu distributes and installs non-free software. I won't sign Ubuntu.
Hey,
thank you. Yeah, it's this.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks.